It's fantastic. I'm really pleased to see so many of you having come to the University of Alberta to this afternoon's talk. I'm Susanna Lumann. I'm an assistant professor in women's studies here at the University of Alberta. And it's my very distinct pleasure to welcome you all this afternoon and to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Gada Tahami. For somebody like myself, who is still fairly junior within the university as a scholar, to look at Dr. Talhami's lengthy CV and the very productive career that this long list of accomplishments documents is both inspiring and just a little intimidating. Gada Hashem Talhami was born in Amman in Jordan, Palestinian parents, and received a high school education in both Amman and Surrey, England. She holds a PhD in African history from the University of Illinois in Chicago. And she is the D.K. Pearson's Professor Emerita of Politics at Lake Forest College in Illinois, which I understand is about an hour north of Chicago. And in 2009, she also was a lecturer at the School of, or since 2009, she's also a lecturer at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. Last year, she was also a visiting professor at California Polytechnic University, or more precisely, the inaugural Susan Currier Visiting Professor of Gender and Global Studies. So when you look at her CV, it does not look like she's really retired, and she just told me she doesn't clearly come back because she's teaching again next year. So there's no retirement. Dr. Talhami is the author of 6 books, and I will only mention the last 4. The Mobilization of Muslim Women in Egypt, published in 1996. Syria and the Palestinians, The Clash of Nationalisms, published in 2002, both by the University Press of Florida. And then in 2003, Palestinian Refugees, Pawns to Political Actors. And in 2007, Palestine and the Egyptian Press, From Al-Aham to Al-Ahali. Further, she is the editor of an encyclopedia volume, Children and the Middle East and North Africa. And she has a very long list of articles and journals and books, I think over 50, on a wide range of topics. Among them, she has published on the Palestinian question. There are a couple more chairs over there. There's one more over there. Are there any more? I think I have my chair. Take my chair for now.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, there's another chair over there. Okay. I don't want you to stand. You have to stand.
It's okay, I'm standing.
Yeah? Okay. So, over 50 articles on a wide range of topics, among them the Palestine question, development in the Arab world, African-Arab relations, women and Islam, Palestinian women, women education and development in the Persian Gulf countries, Palestinian human rights, political Islam, and many other topics. Talhami has and continues to serve on editorial boards and as editor of academic journals, including Arab Studies Quarterly and Alternatives, the Turkish Journal of International Relations. She continues to lecture at various academic institutions in the U.S. and abroad, and was a frequent speaker at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She has been a frequent guest on public television programs, including Chicago Tonight, CNN, ABC, Al Jazeera, and the History Channel. And she has presented her work widely at many international meetings and conferences. In 1997, she received a Senior Scholar Fulbright Research and Lecture Grant to study in Syria. Today she will speak to us on women and Islam. And just before we get started, I would like to thank especially Dr. Abu Rabi, the ECM ECMC Chair in Islamic Studies, and ECMC stands for Edmonton Council of Muslim Communities, and Dr. David Goer from the Chester Ronning Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life. Both of them were instrumental to make this visit and talk possible this afternoon, so thank you so much. But please help me welcome Dr. Tom.
Wave your hand. Yeah. Good evening. It's so wonderful to see so many of you. I hope you can hear me in the back. Okay. I'm a teacher, so my voice projects very well. So I'll make it very loud. Okay. And I also should thank the Women's Studies Department for this wonderful invitation. As you do know, this is the topic of the hour. I think everybody are inquiring about the status of women's rights in the Muslim world. Because as we say in feminist circles, all ideological battles are usually fought over the bodies of women. They really are. It's over the issue of the veil, or over the issue of dress, or what have you. It's really over the bodies of women. Women happen to be silent actors in this drama. But of course, Muslim women, Arab women, I think you're not surprised to know, many of you know this, have been very, very interested in this issue. We also have to remind you, you know this, I don't have to remind you, that we really don't think feminism started in the West. We really now don't think, this is no disparaging remark about Western culture, it's just a fact. We don't think that United States in particular exported concepts of feminism to the developing world. Because as you know, India started its feminist movement independently of the West. In Egypt, we have a very old feminist movement. We now also speak about Iranian feminists who are really living in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this is a strong and vibrant sector of the Arab and the Muslim community worldwide. We also view it, and I also think this is no surprise to you, as an issue of human rights. Okay? This is not just a question of interpreting women's rights in the Quran or women's rights according to the Sharia. In the 21st century, it is really the human rights of women that count. Okay? How do Muslim women view these issues? How do they survive in Western countries, particularly as minority? Because it's really a challenge when you come with a rich cultural background to exist in a powerful economic and social culture like the United States or Canada or the Western world and still maintain your own identity. And by the way, that's the other issue. Women's politics is about identity. It is really identity politics. This is why the status of women in society, which changes, keeps on changing all the time, is an expression of the changing definition of the identity, which evolves and changes every time we undergo a different social revolution. It is really social history. And I'm glad to see a lot of men here in the room, because this is really what it's all about. It's about the social history of the Middle East. Okay. I am a firm believer in something called the cumulative nature of knowledge. This is an interesting phrase, which I think we apply it in different places, meaning that ideas travel from one place to the other. We do not compartmentalize our concepts, and we keep moving and learning from each other's experience. Unfortunately for us Muslims, it's been a one-way street. Because of the overwhelming power of Western culture, Western writing, because of the overwhelming power of the feminist discourse, we have been on the receiving end of all of this development in women's status. And I think it's time to change that. I think it's time to acquaint our sisters and our brothers in the West about how we feel. What are we going through? What you can learn from us, what we can learn from you. But a bit of history here that's very significant. Every time I bring the story up, people are really amazed. You remember Henrik Ibsen's Dollhouse? That has been the most sensational book for Chinese and Indian women and Japanese women in the latter quarter of the 19th century, actually the turn of the century. Everybody were writing articles about what happened to Nora, where did Nora go, what did she do? This is really amazing. As you read the literature, you find out Japanese women, their eyes were really riveted on the story. Chinese women, this is the other side of the globe. This is not Norway, it's the other side of the globe. And yet they were really watching all these events. So there is some kind of a unity on the subject. We're all really, despite the boundaries, addressing each other about these developments. However, we come at this topic with different baggage, with different concepts. One of the concerns, I think, of most third-world feminists today, and there is such a category, and it's a category that encompasses women who are not necessarily Muslim or Arab. It encompasses Muslims and Arabs and what we call women of color. One of their objections has been to the dominant concept of the patriarchy as it has been developed particularly by the second wave of American feminists, meaning the Betty Friedan, the Gloria Steinem, okay, all of these women who have insisted in their writings that the whole struggle of women is against men. It's against dominant males. Now, you know, we sort of pause here a little bit because that's not exactly us. But as a result of this, you will find that the feminist discourse in the West has been, in a sense, critical of the absence of ideology among Arab and Muslim women. They've been critical of the fact that the struggle of Muslim and Arab women has been devoid of this emphasis on the patriarchy. Okay? Well, of course it has been, because the definition of gender in the third world is new. First of all, in Islam, we really don't have a concept of gender. We don't have a concept of class either. Islam teaches us that all Muslims are brothers. إِنَّمَا الْمُسْلِمُونَ أُخْوَةٌ. We're all brothers and sisters. We don't really believe in these divisions. Okay? There are differences between Christians, Muslims, and Jews, but within the Muslim community, they're all one and the same. Okay? But thanks to a new generation of Arab feminists who are very powerful, you know some of their names, the concept of gender has actually entered the studies of Islamic sociology and Arab sociology. I am referring particularly to Nawal Sa'dawi, the Egyptian writer, to Fatima Mernissi, who is really a fascinating historian in her own right, and Layla Ahmed, an Egyptian woman who was the first to enjoy a chair in women's studies at Harvard, and who is really the expert on women in Islam, and she sees the whole depth of the historical experience of women in the Muslim world. These women now have made it very much clear that you cannot understand the development of Arabic and Islamic culture without understanding it through the prism of gender. Okay? But we do object to the fact that we should also look at everything through the prism of gender. Gender isn't everything. This comes from the insights of Afro-American feminists, of a woman like Cheryl Odom, who also says, you know, it's about other things. And it's really for the struggle of third world women. They're not really struggling about women's rights as such. They're struggling with their societies. And they get to be mobilized by events. They begin taking very small steps, asserting their right to participate in public life and in political life. And eventually, they become definitely thoughtful and, in a sense, inquisitive feminists. Okay? We also have the work of somebody called Vandana Shiva, in a beautiful work called The Monocultures of the Mind, in which he says, listen, Western women have to accept the fact that it's not only about gender, it's about class, it's about race, it's about all those struggles together. So we take exception to the idea, and I certainly do, that the feminist issue in the Arab and Muslim world is about empowerment. It is not only about the empowerment of women. It is about how we raise our societies with us, how we come forward with our societies to the forefront. Okay? I want to remind you of a very interesting story that was told in the press about the head of the Federation of the General Union of Palestinian Women, a woman by the name of Asama Abdul Hadi. Asama Abdul Hadi was attending a conference in Yemen when Yemen was very socialist. And when Yemen, unlike today, had given women a great role in society, had actually appointed female judges. This is basically southern Yemen. And in that conference, she was sitting next to Nawal Sa'dawi, the Egyptian feminist. We call Nawal Sa'dawi Egyptian Western feminist. I know Nawal very well. She's a friend of mine. And Asama Abdul Hadi turns to Nawal and says, at this stage of our struggle in Palestine as Palestinians, the enemy is not the Palestinian male, it is the Israeli male. It's not about gender, really. It's about our total struggle in society. This was a shocking remark for Nawal Sa'dawi. And Nawal Sa'dawi has grown over the years. She really has evolved into a woman who understands the politics and the context of the women's struggle in the Arab world. No longer does she pursue the feminist issue as an issue of individual rights, but as an issue of communal and collective rights, which is the way we really view it. We sort of take objection a little bit to United Nations directives on women's issues, because we think everything United Nations comes up with, I know I'm saying something very controversial here, everything comes out of the UN really comes out of a Western perspective. And people in the third world don't view things that way. So, but we're expected to emphasize individual rights, because that's the basis of the human rights concept in the Western world. It is based on individual rights. Whereas really our definition of human rights, and we have a rich tradition of human rights in our religious texts, comes from the idea of the collective human rights of the community rather than on the human rights of the individual as such. Okay. Another interesting example of sort of the gulf that separates us between American feminists. You're familiar with the name of Robin Morgan, I'm sure, editor of Ms. Magazine in the United States. Ms. Magazine is the flagship journal of the National Organization of American Women, Gloria Steinem's journal. And Robin Morgan was sympathetic to Palestinian women at one point. She actually visited the refugee camps in Gaza. She went to Gaza, talked to all the women, and was very saddened by the fact that women tend to have 10 children, 10, 11 children. These are very impoverished people living on the edge, literally on the edge, you know, about to collapse as a family. She said, why do you do that, you know? So they explained to her, you have 10, 11 children because basically only one or two will survive in a situation of war. They'll all die. Okay? But she came back and she wrote a book with a ferocious title called The Demon Lover. The Demon Lover, about Palestinian men being terrorists, of course, who reduce women to the status of baby machines. Now, what is wrong with this approach is that it has a very short historical perspective. Because you do know from your study of history that even the state of Israel encourages pronatalism. Even Israel actually rewards women to have more children because they're worried about the demographic balance between men and women. Societies in time of war, societies in the Soviet Union during World War I, for instance, they'll give medals to women who have many children. So natalism, pronatalism, is not necessarily an expression of backwardness. It is the necessity of war, what societies have to do in time of war. That has been missed by much of the Western feminists, let alone, of course, that they really never bothered to learn about the human rights of women in Islam. And there's a wealth of human rights of women in Islam. Unfortunately, we don't advertise it enough. Our men don't help us in this task because we really say, and I consider myself a Muslim feminist, that we need a second reading of the Quran. We need a second reading of the Islamic text so that the richness of the human rights of women in Islam can really be projected. So let me tell you what I think this is all about. You know, in the United States, the greatest objective of women is to break the glass ceiling. And again, it's one of those human rights that's really based on individualism. It's very important for Gloria Steinem and Robin Morgan that they become CEOs of companies, that like Hillary Clinton, they become Secretary of State, and perhaps one of these days become President of the United States. I hope that too. I think the United States can stand to have a woman president, as long as it's not Sarah Palin. I'll take any other woman. I will take any other woman, as long as it's not Sarah Palin. Okay? The point about all this, which is very interesting, is that it's about economic rights. Do you know how much economic rights women have in Islam? The Quran being a revealed text, because we believe it's a revealed divine text, dating back to the 6th century, has already given women a lot of economic rights. Women own property in Islam. They can actually sign in their own name for their property. They inherit, even though they inherit half of the share of the male, for a good reason. Because in the context of the 6th century, okay, males were responsible for women anyhow, and women were always protected. And even today, you know, when something happens, a woman loses her husband, loses her main provider, a brother will always take care of her because this is how society expects it to be. Okay. But the important thing is that woman was a legal entity in Islam. And this is very, very clear. And indeed, the enjoyment of economic rights preceded the enjoyment of economic rights in the West by centuries. The first time women could own property in their own name in Western societies was with the passage of Women's Property Acts in Britain in the latter quarter of the 19th century. Before that, if you go back to your British history, when a woman married, she would actually pass her wealth on to her husband, automatically. So she was not really a legal entity as much as Muslim women were. We have to bear in mind all this. The Quran regards women as the sisters of men. It actually addresses them as the sisters of men. Okay? The Quran talks about the story of Adam and Eve, does not attach to it the concept of the sin. There is no sin concept associated with the fall of paradise, the original sin. Instead, it's actually the problem of both Adam and Eve together. And unlike in Christian theology, where the problem of the original sin is really attached to Eve, there's none of that in Islam, absolutely. Okay? Islam also regards women as being the foundation of society, so to speak. Now, you might say, how could that be when there is polygamy, when there is divorce, etc., etc.? So let's go back to the text and see what we're talking about. Okay? The problem, of course, with Muslim civilization as such is that the Quran, being such a wonderful document, when the Sharia wrote its laws, that's the body of Islamic law that we use in the Muslim world, it turned out to be an interpretive approach to the holy text, to the Sharia, to the Muhammad's speeches, to comparative law, to the pre-Islamic law. And it was really frozen in stone. Nobody bothered to think about what time and change will do to these women's rights in the Sharia. The Quran is not a bunch of laws. It does not give you laws. What it gives you are moral directives. So it says a man is allowed to marry once, twice, three times, four times, if he can be fair to all of them. And then it adds, but you shall never be fair. And that legal rider at the end explains the whole story. Indeed, as Imam Muhammad Abdo, the great Mufti, the great Archbishop of Egypt at the turn of the 1920th century, has concluded, Quran and Islam do not actually call upon men to take four wives. They simply say you can, in extreme necessity, take more than one wife. What is that extreme necessity? If your wife does not bear children, if the first wife is ill, it is considered much more humane to keep her under your roof than to force her to live under somebody else's roof. Okay, so Muslim men abuse this? Yes, because the Sharia never saw fit to provide punishment for transgression on this statement. And the statement clearly says that you will never be fair to all these women. So when you take a second wife, make sure that it is really for a good reason. In my community, I come from an old Muslim family. We don't have a single polygamous case for the last 50 years. We don't have a single divorce case for the last 50 years because the culture doesn't tolerate it. In our own community, we don't just tolerate this business. In some cultures, I suppose they do. How about divorce? Well, Islam supposedly makes divorce easy. And as you see in the Hollywood movies, all a man has to do is to utter the divorce oath. All he has to do is to say, I divorce thee, I divorce thee, I divorce thee three times, and the woman goes home. That's not the way it works. This is called summary divorce. And indeed, it's abhorred by the Quran and by Muhammad. Because the Quran says divorce is the most heinous act in the eyes of Allah. It is the most heinous act in the eyes of Allah. And I remember me and my sisters, I grew up in a family of four girls. Whenever we were about to get married, my father would give us a lecture. Again, no divorce. Go ahead, you can get married tomorrow, but there will be no divorce tolerated in this family. That serious, they look at the issue of divorce. You think they're Catholics. They really like the Catholic Church. Okay? Now, men continue to divorce their wives, but that is not respected in society. Okay? And by the way, I forgot to mention, the percentage of polygamous marriages today in the Muslim world, I would adjust that, in the Arab world, is about 4%. Polygamous marriages, 4%. Economics have taken care of it. The high cost of living has eliminated it. As my own dad used to say, imagine all four wives going shopping together one day. So that just will ruin a family's budget. So literally, it is really unfeasible. Women go to universities, get educated, choose their own husband. Islam, by the way, allows a woman to choose her own husband. This is allowed. Islam considers a woman capable of even approaching a man and proposing a match, a marriage match. We don't do it today because social custom does not accept it, but it is allowed in Islam. This is part of the concepts that we really have to deal with. Okay? Divorce today is extremely restrictive. It has been restricted through all kinds of legislation that sort of encroaches a little bit on the Sharia very, very slowly. Even in conservative countries like Jordan, like Egypt. Egypt is not socially that advanced. And the idea is to sort of force the male to go to court and register the divorce decree. He has to go and say why he wants to divorce his wife. And indeed, even before that kind of reform, a woman could actually sue for divorce according to certain categories. And we've been pushing to enlarge those categories. For instance, historically, a woman could seek divorce if the husband wasn't providing for her, if he was, of course, mentally incapacitated, if there was a case of abandonment, and if there was domestic abuse. I know very well of Sharia judges in Amman, where I grew up, where they actually ruled against the man if he actually abused his wife. Domestic abuse is not tolerated in Islam. I don't need to tell you this, that domestic abuse occurs among the wealthiest and most affluent white society in the West. Where I teach at Lake Forest, which is really a millionaire's suburb in Chicago, where the average price of a home is $3 million. We don't live in Lake Forest. We live in a small, cheaper town down below. In Lake Forest, there's a lot of domestic abuse. It's because of pressure, because of competition. If you ask Sarah Palin and the neocons, they would say it's because of feminism. It's because feminism empowered women, and so sort of it took away all the power of males, and the male has been overreacting and fighting back. No, we don't tolerate domestic abuse. Does it happen? Yes, of course it happens. It happens all the time in the Muslim world. We have to make it really ironclad that it doesn't happen. Also, Islam allows a woman to retain the right of divorce in the marriage contract. In Islam, the marriage contract is a civil contract. It is not a sacrament. So we don't get married in the mosque, we get married at home. And we register the marriage decree in the court. So it is really a civil document. Okay? A woman could ask to include in her contract the right of divorce. We call it haqq al-asma. Traditionally, this has been the privilege of upper-class, powerful women, particularly if they married below their class or below their rank, which is very interesting. And unfortunately, poorer, uneducated women are not aware of this right. You really have to teach them this right, more or less. But it exists on the books, and it can be actually resorted to. Within the last 10 years, we have now created a new concept of divorce that is really revolutionary. And now, it simply was a matter of rereading of the Quran, as I'm saying. And a lot of jurists, males, who actually pushed for it. It wasn't only the women. And that is what is known as a divorce by a woman's initiative, or khula in Islam. A woman now, it began in Jordan, by the way, a woman now in Jordan and in Egypt could go to court and say, I would like a divorce. And I have no reason. There is no reason. I just don't like him. He can leave now. What she has to do, of course, she will forfeit her rights, her economic rights. So she will not get a back dowry. But she can actually say, I have the right of khula. And it's accepted by all jurists, which is really fascinating. We have learned, by the way, over the years, all of us ardent feminists, not only to become interested in this business of really knowing the text for ourselves, we want to know the Islamic text for ourselves, but also to rely on the exploiting differences between the different jurisprudence schools in the Sharia. You know, the Sharia comes in four schools of jurisprudence, named after four different imams. Okay, in Palestine, most of us follow the Hanafi school. Okay, then there is, of course, the Hanbali in Saudi Arabia, which is very, very conservative. There is Maliki and there is Shafi'i. The Maliki is in North Africa. So each school tends to be a little bit different on certain issues. So we kind of exploit that. The Hanafi school is a little bit conservative. The Maliki school in North Africa is kind of a little bit more wide open. So we learned to do this over the years, sort of to know the text very well ourselves and fight this battle ourselves. We have not yet gotten to the point where we succeed in having the appointment of female Sharia judges. We don't have that. We have a small number of female judges in civil courts in Jordan and in Egypt. I don't know why the prohibition on a woman being a judge, but traditionally speaking, Islam has regarded woman as somebody to be protected. See, actually treats women with respect, but somebody to be protected. And the idea was to expose women to what goes on in the court of law, was really to expose them to all of society's ills and problems. So it wasn't even acceptable. Okay. Be that as it may, over the years, of course, the status of women has suffered. But I contend, and I don't think anybody can argue about that, that the diminution of the status of women is not the problem of Islam. It is the problem of what happened to Muslim men and women over the centuries of decline that we call the centuries of colonization and decline. Indeed, the status of males has also declined. It wasn't only the women. That's really a fact. And so I'm amazed when you go around in Western society and you see that people blame Islam on a variety of things. People blame Islam for the loss of human rights in the Muslim world. It has nothing to do with Islam. You know, go see the wealth of the emphasis on the rights of human being in Islam. Islam says you cannot take a human life because God gives life and God takes life. And in the Quran it says, if you kill a human being, it's like you killed me. It's like you killed God. You cannot take a human life. There's a whole wealth of this Islam that we don't know about. And everybody accuses us of abuse of human rights. In the Western discourse, the Muslim world is also accused of being anti-capitalist. Nothing is further from the truth. There's a clear concept of ownership in Islam. A clear concept of property. There's a great emphasis on contracts. We actually now have a field called Islamic economics, which is beginning to make sense to some people in Britain in particular. I'm not the expert here. I can't really debate it. But it is very true that this really hypothetical, the idea that Islam is a primitive communal religion doesn't make sense because it gave birth to great civilizations. And these civilizations were based on an organized exploitation and organization of wealth, right? It's only common sense. You cannot use that. Okay, so a lot of things get blamed on Islam. Okay, yeah, low status of women, you blame it on Islam. Again, a very superficial observation, if I may say so. We now find out that at the turn of the 19th, 20th century, particularly in Egypt, it began in Egypt, Muslim males began to push for granting women more rights. Muslim males. So we speak of the phenomena of male feminists in the Muslim world. And there are many of them, male feminists. This is because they recognized during a period which we call al-Nahda, or the period of the Renaissance, of the Arabic Renaissance, that you cannot improve Egyptian society, Arab society, without improving the status of women. You cannot improve the status of men without improving the status of women. They both go together. Okay? In feminist studies, when you do a comparative study of this and of what was happening in India, you arrive at something called the bourgeois ideal. And the bourgeois ideal is the desire of those men to have educated females. Maybe sit-home females, but they have to be educated to raise their children in order to fight the charge of primitivism and backwardness, which, of course, the colonialists applied to them. Remember, the colonial powers sort of exaggerated. Maybe we were barbarian, I don't know. But they exaggerated the barbarianism of the other in order to justify their own barbarian behavior in the third world. So what best about doing that than to say, look at their family life, look how they treat their women. And indeed, that was the great motivation for the greatest name that called for giving women their rights, Qasim Amin, a lawyer in Egypt. Now, the battle in the early part of the 20th century in Egypt was about the veil. And the veil is not the veil today. You know, the veil is a big thing. It's not just covering your hair. The veil in those days was covering your face. The veil used to restrict women from movement, from going around, from doing anything. It really confined women to their home. And Westerners picked up on this and used to write about this, especially the French, and used to make fun of Muslim society about this. So Qasim Amin began to call for the removal of the veil. And this caught on like wildfire in Egypt. But they didn't really remove the veil completely. Even Huda Sharawi, the greatest feminist in the Arab world and the founder of this movement, continued to cover her hair. So, you know, don't think the idea of the veil is the same in every century, in every place. For North African women, the veil used to be a complete cover to the floor with little windows for the eyes. When the French saw this in Algeria, they kept writing about a woman moving and taking her prison with her, like this is really her prison. But they didn't understand this. What they didn't understand is what somebody wrote in a book called The Eloquence of Silence. It's a beautiful book, in which it's really explained that women deliberately in 20th century Algeria covered themselves up to avoid harassment by the French, who used to take over the women of the colonies. Yeah. You find in some areas in the Persian Gulf countries, women wear this, I think, very ugly metal covering. It covers the whole face. It's a metal mask, which keeps the eyes open. Dig a little bit into that history. This is because they were afraid of the Portuguese, when the Portuguese sailors would land, actually, in the Persian Gulf area and would come after women. So the best way to do it, just cover your face with this mask, metal mask. See this in Bahrain. You see it in Qatar. You see it in parts of Yemen. I actually saw some women like that in Egypt a few years ago. There's a good reason for that. Everything has a rationale. But, you know, the Western mentality was in a hurry to rationalize its own exploitation of these countries. Okay? So the Egyptian women fought the battle of the long cover, complete cover of the face, and also fought for the battle of attaining admission to universities, wanted to be admitted to parliament in order to legislate and be legislators. They discovered, as all other generations of Arab and Muslim women discovered, that, and I think as American feminists have discovered, that the only way you can really establish your foothold in society is to participate in a society's national movement. So the Egyptian women were very much participants in the revolution of 1919. They were in the forefront of the demonstrations against British soldiers. When the national groups in Egypt wanted to stage a boycott of British goods before World War I, the women were the first ones to come abroad. You know why? Women are in charge of the domestic economy. They buy. They're the ones who buy. So women became very important as the people who could really enforce the boycott movement. Okay. Despite all these sacrifices, despite the rise of a very vibrant women's press in the 1920s and 30s in Egypt, when women began to write something like Ladies Magazine, Ladies Home Journal, you know, emphasizing the bringing up of children, hygiene issues, home decoration, little by little they evolved into writing poetry, writing novels, demanding issues from their own government. So the feminist press was no longer a decorative press. Like what we still see sometimes, even in the United States, it became really a feminist press. Despite all this, by the time Huda Sharawi died, and she was really a saint, this is the leader of this movement, she was a wife of a member of this nationalist elite. Her father was a prime minister in Egypt. She was tutored at home by tutors where she learned French and Italian, very little, and Turkish, very little Arabic. She didn't even learn Arabic very much. Her first magazine was published in French. It was called L'Egyptien. It wasn't even in Arabic. Eventually, they called it Al-Masriya. Okay? Despite all that, she was the saint of this movement. By the time she died, 1947, okay, they haven't achieved much. All they really have achieved is the right of women to sit in the upper balcony in the Egyptian parliament to observe the debates in the upper balcony. But they also won the right to enter university in the 1930s. And we began to have our first batch of university professors who were women. And that was a great achievement. So indeed, there's a big difference between this kind of feminism and, I think, Western feminism. This is a feminism of service more than anything else. I know this is the title of the activities of many Palestinian women. Whenever you look at Palestinian feminism, you realize it's about serving the community. It's a feminism of service. It's not about what you can become, what you can empower yourself. And then, of course, Nasser comes to the government in Egypt, and we have our first experience with a socialist government who tries to apply socialist economics in the 1950s. And Nasser of Egypt introduces something what we call state feminism, a concept of state feminism, by which what he tries to do, because he needed really to unleash the potential of the working population by recruiting men and women for his own industrialization projects of Egypt, he begins to force businesses and industries in Egypt to provide certain rights for working women. A woman under Nasser, if she was employed in any factory employing 100 or more employees, was entitled to 1 year maternity leave, entitled for a break for nursing her child, was given all kinds of inducement and comfort when she had a baby and continued to work. And we've never seen this anywhere really in the Arab world. Yet even Nasser balked before confronting the Sharia, never really confronted the big jury consults of the great Islamic seminary Al-Azhar. He used the Al-Azhar. He used the Azhar clergy in his battle in Africa when he wanted to encourage Islamic states in Africa to support his Arab nationalism and socialism. They went along with him. They gained a great deal of prestige. But he never broached the subject of women's rights, and they never even attempted to offer it. He did something very interesting. He forced Al-Azhar University, I think you know what it is. Al-Azhar is the oldest continuing university in the world, dating back to the 11th century, to be followed a few years later by University of Bologna in Italy. So it has the longest tradition in the world of continuous education. And of course it was closed to women. Finally, because of Nasser, women were actually admitted to Al-Azhar. Of course they study separately. And we have a Sharia college where women are graduated. A few years ago, the director of the Sharia college, a woman, asked the head of Al-Azhar if she would be allowed to issue opinions, judicial opinions, fatwa, concerning women's issues only. He wouldn't let her. And he continued to feel that issuing legislative opinions, this interesting fatwa term that I think you're familiar with from Salman Rushdie's story, okay? Now, in the American press, they say she lives under a fatwa. They say Ayan Hirsi Ali lives under a fatwa, that there's a fatwa against her. It is not that automatic, but it is very true. There's a class of professional clergy who kind of specialize in issuing any kind of opinion, rational or irrational, and mostly about women. That's what's really upsetting, mostly about women. So now the women are saying, we have a right to issue these opinions. We're educated. Nobody would really give them that opportunity. Okay. Of course, Nasser's socialism in Egypt failed, and he lost also because he lost his struggle with Israel in the 1967 war. And by the time he died, a natural death in 1970, and we ended up with President Sadat of Egypt, we have experienced under Sadat the most bewildering example of co-optational politics when it comes to women's issues. The reason I'm emphasizing Egypt, by the way, is to say that much of the initiatives about legislation comes out of Egypt. Really, Egypt is the leader of the Arab world in many ways. It's not necessarily the most liberal, but the weight of all the legislative institutions is in Egypt. The weight of the universities is in Egypt. So we watch with great concern what comes out of Egypt. Mr. Sadat happened to have, of course, a very interesting wife, Jehan Sadat, whose mom was English. Her father was an Egyptian doctor, and who really, I don't think she ever knew about Huda Sha'rawi very much. She sort of grew up in a pampered environment and proceeded to become the voice of women in Egypt by virtue of her marriage to her husband. And she convinced her husband in the late 1970s to introduce something called Law 40, which colloquially in Egypt is known as Jehan's Law. Colloquially, people make fun of it. They say it's Jehan's Law. By which, when a man takes a second wife without permission by his first wife, the first wife, if she has children underage, can keep the home and kick him out of the house. And he also is forced to support her and her children. Well, this was like a ton of rocks over the heads of Egyptian males, because Egypt has a horrible housing crisis anyhow. People can't find homes anyhow. And they were screaming and being very unhappy. Well, she and her friends were doing all kinds of propaganda, actually, for the passage of this law. Unfortunately, this is what's so sad, is that when the women's issue is manipulated by politicians, we lose. We women lose. We really gain more when reforms are introduced in the democratic way. Unfortunately for all of us, Sadat forced Parliament to sign it when actually Parliament was in recess. He did not submit the law to debate. So the young scholars, the young jury consuls of Al-Azhar were howling in the streets. And when Jihad Sadat is saying in all of her articles, polygamy is wrong, Islam never actually called for polygamy, they'll point a finger at her and say, where would you be before polygamy? She was Sadat's second wife. And she married him when he was actually married already to his first wife. You know, there's utter duplicity about this. But there's a very interesting lesson here. You think that Jihad Sadat got up one morning and decided to introduce this law? No. She was heavily influenced by the research and the studies of a woman called Dr. Aziza Hussein. Dr. Aziza Hussein, she just died recently, was the wife of the Egyptian ambassador in Washington for a long time, and the foremost expert on population growth in Egypt. As you know, Egypt has a population problem. The Egyptian population increases by about 1 million a year. It is now probably approaching 80 million. Under Nasser, it was about 40 million. They have a horrible population growth that they cannot really check. Aziza Hussein, American educated, friend of Jihan, convinced her, as indeed some economists convinced her, that unless there are some regulations to curb polygamy, the size of the Egyptian family will continue to quadruple and multiple. Okay? Because you see, the whole system is built in favor of boys. For instance, in the villages, when a woman produces a child, if the first child is a female, and she produces the second child and it's another female, her husband may think of taking another wife because he wants a male heir. Now you say, why does he want a male heir? Is he that stupid? No, he's not that stupid. He wants a male heir because under our system, and that's what we're fighting to reform over the years, if he dies and he leaves some wealth and he only has one daughter, the wealth is divided among his daughter and her uncles. It goes outside of family. If he has a boy, we say the boy is a barrier, acts as a barrier, and keeps the wealth within his family. So the inheritance laws favor boys in a very peculiar way that has to be adjusted. Okay? Indeed, we're talking seriously about adjusting this. I think it's been changed in Egypt already. I have to check on that. It's been a long hue and cry about it. So, you know, a man continues to marry in order to produce a male child. Okay? Now, what's wrong with this? What's wrong is that this is an American idea, regulating the population by virtue of the edicts of Aziza Hussein is an American idea. And that upset the Egyptians terribly. The Egyptians were obsessed with the idea that Americans were studying their mating habits, so to speak, in order to write about them. You know, there are studies and studies. They send university students to study the Egyptian family, fertility patterns. I remember one headline when I was in Egypt doing research in Arabic, which is hilarious. It says, "An American in your bedroom." An American is really watching what you're doing because that goes into the research records of his own university. Well, we do the same in China. I mean, we send American students to China to study the fertility patterns in China and what the Chinese do about abortion. We do the same. Now, that's offensive to many people. It brings to mind an issue that is totally absent from the discourses of Western feminists, and that is the legitimacy of the reformer. The reformer has to be viewed as legitimate. If the reformer is not legitimate, no one will listen. Who was Jihan Sadat? And indeed, the students at Al-Azhar will say, who is Jihan Sadat? She's a woman, first of all. You know, she doesn't have authority. She is not a scholar, an Islamic scholar. Who are those Americans telling us what to do? They're not Muslims. Where is your legitimacy? So the legitimacy of the reformer is a very important item that is missing from the understanding of the difficulty of reform in the Arab world and in the Muslim world. Reform has to be done by the most expert of experts, the people who know the religious texts. And we are trying to study the religious texts as much as we can as women, so we can really argue our case as much as we can all the time. Now, in the midst of all this, we run across, of course, in the Western world, what I call really the new neocon feminists, the women who are trying to blast Islam irrationally for things that Islam is really free of, and women who endear themselves to the feminist current, particularly in the United States, by literally stabbing their culture in the back. Well, you can stab your culture in the back if you have a leg to stand on. But these two women I'm going to bring to your attention don't have a leg to stand on. They are not of the weight of Fatima Mernissi, who knows Islamic history. They are not scholars of the text. They're absolutely ignorant. But they have been pampered, lionized, pushed forward, and made into leaders. particularly in the United States, to a ridiculous degree. I am referring to Ayan Hirsi Ali and one of your own products in Canada, Irshad Manji. She's one of your own, right? Well, you know Ayan Hirsi Ali is Somali, right? And she grew up in Holland. She has good education, by the way. She studied at Leiden University in Holland. She studied constitution, so she's a lawyer of sorts. She developed a great animus against Islam because of, she claims her parents attempted to arrange a marriage for her, as if arranging marriages was such an abhorrence to her. I mean, I can even defend arranged marriages, really. Because you have to think about it, it's better than a rate of divorce in Western societies of 3 to 5 in the United States. 3 to 5 marriages fail in the United States because people choose their mates as they wish. We think maybe there's a role for the family in choosing your mate, in telling you whom to marry. And now, Ayan Hirsi Ali, in her greater book, what is it? What is it?
It's called Nomad.
Nomad, that's her latest. That's her latest. No, she has another one. Wait a minute. Yeah, I've got to remember her name. First one is, Infidel. And the other one is The Cage Version. She's the cage version and she's waiting for Western culture to free her. Her utter ignorance is displayed by the fact that she says there has been no reformers in Islam. No reformers in Islam? Does she know her history? Does she know how many people fought for reform in Islam? She says Muslims actually encourage female circumcision. No way. This does not come out of Muslim culture. This comes out of African culture. What is she, you know, Irshad Munji is even simpler, of a simpler mind. Irshad Munji, again, I have to remember her book. Her book
What's
is called? The Trouble with Islam. And her last chapter in that book, it says, Thank God for the West. The Trouble with Islam, the last chapter is, Thank God for the West. Irshad Munji is an unapologetic pro-Zionist. She says Muslims are bad because they don't like Jews and they don't like Zionists. And she says Muslims and Palestinians are anti-Semitic. She makes that blanket statement. She says they are anti-Semitic. What's wrong with that statement? Let me tell you. You should know this. Our Prophet had problems with the Jewish community of Medina, but we never developed an anti-Semitic ideology. We continued all our lives to regard Jews and Christians as people of the book. And we respect them as people of the book. As I grew up in Jerusalem, I'm a Palestinian, and I get mad at what the Israelis are doing as a little girl, and I go blasting, the Jews did this, the Jews did that. My mom would wave her finger in my face and say, you say Zionists, you don't say Jews. We have to respect Jews. Who said Muslims are anti-Semites? These women are ignorant. And yet at the same time, Ayan Hirsi Ali wrote her book actually by being a researcher at the American Free Enterprise Institute. Irshad Munji was given a professorship at Princeton. Now, Princeton wouldn't even hire me for a professorship. They hire her for a professor. She has a bachelor's degree. She has a radio program. That's all she has. This is really what I call Muslim neocons. I really think that a certain wing of the Bush administration in Washington had so fit to attack us by bringing forward these kind of ignorant women who are really an insult to Islam, if I may say so, an insult to Islam. There's nothing wrong with taking issues with your civilization, how Islamic history went, but there is something wrong with simply adulterating the record, being ignorant, not really knowing the record. Okay? I want to end with a very interesting piece of reading. I don't usually read when I give talks, but this is something I cannot rehearse by myself. This is a piece by a Jordanian novelist by the name of Fadia Faqir. This is from a book of hers called Stories from the House of Songs. Okay? Essays by Arab women writers, and it's published in 1988. And it's a book that captures how we Muslim women growing up in the West feel, what we face, both by Western ignorance and by abuse from our own societies. And it's a very poignant kind of a statement. It says, in exile, you feel outnumbered and outorganized by a culture which violates and enforces the supremacy of everything that is Christian, Western, white, and written. You know, much of our culture is also oral. Okay, then she adds, at the least provocation, distaste for immigrant culture comes to the surface. What you left behind in your own country of origin becomes clear dictatorship, fundamentalism, and the mutilation of the mind. But you cannot fight the authoritarian mullahs without fighting reductionism, colonialism, and misinterpretation in the Western media. You have to do both. Okay? In your country of adoption, you suddenly realize that to use the words as Fred Holliday did in his essay, The Struggle for the Migrant Soul, you have to turn a critical face both ways towards the country of origin and its traditions and the country of reception. The challenge, the alienation, the offense are two-sided. The challenge and the offense are really two-sided. Look, women have achieved a lot in the Muslim and Arab world. I'm going to continue here a little bit. I want to say that we have seen powerful women leaders, usually by virtue of being wives or sisters of powerful men. I want to remind you only of some of them, very, very briefly. You know the work of the sister of the Shah of Iran, Princess Ashraf, who actually single-handedly negotiated an agreement with Saddam Hussein, called the Algiers Accords, which brought an end to the Shatt al-Arab dispute. Very formidable woman. She's still alive, lives in Paris. We have the model of the wife of the former president of Tunisia, Wasila Bourguiba, who was really a woman who could negotiate on his behalf in other countries. We have today the example of Sheikh Hamouza of Qatar. She's actually the second wife of the ruler of Qatar. An unbelievably successful woman, a woman who is committed to development, really developing her women. What does this tell us? It tells us something very interesting that I'd like to close on, and that is a number of women in the Middle East and the Muslim world have attained power, but they lack authority. They don't have authority. So power without authority is really precarious. It calls upon us to struggle in a very organized way, to struggle in order to achieve constitutional rights, to struggle in order to tell our leaders that sometimes it is the duty of the leader, because Islam calls on leaders to exercise something called in the interest of maslaha, in the interest of the common interest, the ruler must intervene in order to put an end to abuses. Unfortunately, most of our rulers have been mostly concerned with maintaining their seats of power, and very little concerned with the status of women. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We have time for questions and discussion.
Do you sure. Stand there?
Do you want to sit, put
your oh, I can stand here. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. So, questions, responses.
You refer to yourself as a Muslim feminist, and that's a term that Margot Bertrand has researched a lot. Mm-hmm. And some take that term as a vexed term. Mm-hmm. Some say it's already an oxymoron, mm-hmm. being a Muslim feminist. How would you respond to that kind of objection?
Well, we don't like the term feminist. I mean, we don't have that understanding, I think, in Islam. Somebody suggested the use of the term womanist. We're interested in women, womanist, yeah. We're different than Western feminists, it's very obvious. But there is, of course, Muslim feminists, and you'll find them in Iran. I think Muslim women in Iran are formidable, even today, under the Islamic Republic. You see, the Islamic Republic has given them political rights. They vote, they sit in parliament. The vice president of Iran, Masuma, under Khatami, was a woman. The women in Iran have also understood that they have to make a battle for social rights. And you will find the items they're really calling for are unbelievable. Western women haven't even thought of them. One of which, they haven't achieved that yet, but one of which is to call on the courts to grant women compensation for doing domestic work. That, you know, in Islam, a woman doesn't have to serve her husband, really. A husband serves himself, she serves herself. A woman is not a servant to her husband, not according to the Muslims who know their religion. Okay? These women are again emphasizing the fact that they don't like multiple marriages. They haven't gotten there yet. They fought and won a battle against temporary marriage in Iran. they reminded the Iranian government that this is nonsense. You know, you don't call for temporary marriage, which is really deceptive of the first wife, destructive of the family. You know, now we have gotten to the point where I think we argue rationally, because that's what the battle is all about. It's about rationalization. It's about what we really should call the Islamic counter-narrative to modernization. Modernization doesn't have to come all from the West. We can bring modernist ideas from our inner understanding of our own culture. And I don't mean that we close our minds to what's going on around us, but I mean there's a wealth of information that we can really use. Okay? We can really argue for many, many, many rights. Women in Iran have had their own press in recent years, and their press has argued many, many issues. And one of the issues they argue all the time is that polygamy destroys families. Polygamy destroys families. It's not only divorce that destroys families. Polygamy creates jealousy among siblings. It creates competition among wives. It just doesn't fit the demands of the 20th century. So I think, I firmly believe there is such a thing called Western feminism. You can call it what you wish. But I think, yeah, the term feminism evokes the idea of a feminism that emphasizes sexual rights. And that's not what Muslim women are about. You know, they're really fighting essential rights, really essential, very important rights. I can't believe I convinced all of you.
Whose daughter? Noemi Darwish.
Who is that?
Oh, she's an Egyptian woman who lives in the States now, who's written a book called Now They Call Me Infidel.
Oh, Now They Call Me Infidel. There's a number of these women. There's a woman who's a Syrian. I don't know her name. She gets on TV.
From California.
What's her name? Yeah, I don't know what her name is. Look. Yeah, look, all you have to do is to go along with the demands of the media in the States, and you become a star. And we don't want to become a star. We want to be effective within our own culture. I mean, you know, who's Irshad Munji that she now gets invited to the highest places? It's unbelievable. There's an abuse of this kind of women, where they allow themselves to be abused. You have to be true to your own culture, really. You cannot separate yourself from your culture, or you lose. You lose a great deal. And again, I really don't wish to offer an isolationist viewpoint. That's why I began with the story of Dollhouse by Henrik Ibsen. We learn from each other. We like meeting each other as women. I enjoy going to feminist conferences. Fortunately or unfortunately, I attend a lot of the NOW conferences annually, the National Organization of Women. I go with women of color. I go with a caucus called Women of Color. Color is not color. I'm not black, but my mind is. My mind is a colonized mind. So color is not your skin. Is really what your outlook in life is. So yeah, I feel much more comfortable with Afro-American women, with Asian women. That's me. I'm not a white woman. So please.
In your studies, have you ever been able to draw the line between cultural issues and religious issues when it comes to women issues?
No, you really can't. I don't think you can really draw a line. I hope you can go further with your question. What exactly are you drawing at? What do you?
When you talk about Sharia and Quran,
mm-hmm.
There is the interpretation of what the Quran says,
mm-hmm.
and it has been interpreted differently over the years.
That's right.
The example of Kemal Atatürk
mm-hmm.
in Turkey,
mm-hmm.
when he just did away with all the ulemas.
Mm-hmm.
and started a new country mm-hmm. with a different concept, a new language.
Mm-hmm.
He managed to put that issue aside,
mm-hmm.
the separate culture
mm-hmm.
from religion.
I think probably what you mean, cultural identity. I didn't talk about Ataturk, but it's an important strand of the feminist experience that we should confront. It is only not only Kemal Ataturk, but of course El Habib Bourguiba in Tunisia, who was a student of Ataturk. Ataturk was a great admirer of the West. He wanted to make Turkey into a Western nation. When he changed the Turkish alphabet from Arabic to Latin, people told him the Turks will not be able to read their own history. He said, good. I don't want them to read their own history. Well, now, had he lived long enough, I think he would have revised his opinions, because he would find out there's a return to Islam in Turkey.
Yeah.
Why? It's the identity. You cannot create deracinated people. Okay? This, in the words of political psychologists, is something what leads to alienation. You cannot create generations that are alienated from their own culture. I think Al-Habib Bourguiba did better. I think Al-Habib Bourguiba, being also a student of Ataturk, he really admired Ataturk. Shah Reza of Iran also admired Ataturk. He created a school of reform. Bourguiba said he would like ijtihad, not simply throwing away Sharia, not simply closing the courts. And he said, we need to do this. We need to reinterpret things. So he didn't throw away everything. Incidentally, even though Bourguiba eliminated polygamy, changed many things in the Sharia, he did not change the inheritance laws. The inheritance laws still favor sons rather than daughters. So there's some things he didn't touch. With Ataturk, it was massive. It's massive deracination, as we say. That does not work. I think one of the reasons we admire British culture, if I may say so, and I've studied in England as a young girl, and I got to understand why they have something perhaps even in the Middle East we're lacking. The Brits have social discipline. Many countries have that, particularly in the West. And what you notice is many things in Britain are readapted to serve in a modern way. Okay, the House of Lords has become now an adapted institution. The monarchy has changed its role. They don't throw it away. They transform it. In terms of political psychology, this is very healthy. It allows people to maintain contact with their past in a very orderly way. Think about it. It really makes a lot of sense. By the way, I met Bourguiba when I was maybe 15 years old. In France, now I'll give away my age. My dad was a diplomat in France 1 year, and the Arab ambassadors were all excited because we were going to watch a theatrical performance by Youssef Wahbi. He came from Egypt and he was going to put on a show about Rasputin. So my parents corralled me to go with them. I went with mom and dad, and there was Al-Habib Bourguiba. Al-Habib Bourguiba has just been released from prison in France, and he was about to go back and become the first president of Tunisia. Well, guess what? He doesn't know Arabic. He's a blue-eyed blonde. Shook hands with everybody, spoke in French. I mean, amazing. Had a French wife with him. So yeah, I think he was a part of a different culture. We were all stunned. This is a man who's going to lead an Arab country. Oh, very fluent in French. Few Arabic words, no, he doesn't know French. He knew some Turkish. Some Turkish. Amazing. That kind of leadership, I think, is gone in the Middle East. I think if you're talking about the grassroots movements, we were talking the other day about Hezbollah, about Hamas, about the new grassroots movements. You need to be in touch with your public. And you cannot be totally enamored by the West. There's a whole baggage that comes with Western culture that you cannot just put it on you and move and say, well, now I'm French. You know, now, as Kemal Ataturk said, Turkey is now Western. Turkey is not Western. Apparently, it will never be Western. I wish he lived long enough. Would have had a nice debate with him. Yes.
Thank you very much for your talk. I have a couple of questions. One is just about how there's a woman named Julia Emberley, who's a cultural critic, and I was reading something she wrote the other day, and she said that at this moment, the Muslim woman is kind of takes up that place of the abject female body, the way the woman in pornography used to be the abject body that would motivate us to go in and save her. And she's concerned about how Muslim women, for instance, in Afghanistan have been used on some level to justify all kinds of military engagement.
Yeah.
And it's ongoing. It doesn't seem to be ending.
Yeah.
In fact, I just noticed there was, you know, anyway, we're supposed to be leaving Afghanistan, and there are more new initiatives. The Red Cross is taking up Afghani women. I mean, these are all very legitimate and wonderful things, mm-hmm. but I'm just a little concerned about how it's implicated in our military mm-hmm. engagement. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, you know, the whole thing about Islam is that it's a worldwide religion. You know how many Muslims are in the world? 1.25 billion and growing? Okay, so we cannot generalize. That's the whole point. And certainly the way in which the Taliban treated women in Afghanistan does no honor to Muslims. And everybody objected in the Muslim world. By the way, Islam never calls on people to isolate women. Isolating women, forcing them to stay in their house, is a punishment for infidelity. Really, if you read the Quran, you do not force a woman like a slave to be in her own house. In Egypt, we used to have some kind of an aberration, something called the House of Obedience, which continued until the 1950s. The House of Obedience, I don't know when it started, allows a man to literally confine his wife to the house and lock her in, keep the key, if he had a dispute with her, rather than divorce her. And if she attempted to leave the house, he can call the police on her. This was actually in the law. And many Egyptian reformers fought against this. Finally, well, of course, they don't dare stand up to this because somebody gets up and says, but it's actually an Islamic custom. Well, you have to fight it, even if it is an Islamic custom, if it's bad. Finally, under Nasser, okay, a minister stood up in parliament and actually defied all the parliamentarians and said, whoever of you is still in favor of maintaining the House of Obedience, raise his hand. He shamed them into making a public display of approval of the House of Obedience, and nobody dared. So they eliminated it. No, the Taliban are an aberration. This is not our Islam. We are ashamed of the way they treat women. I am ashamed of the way we treat women. Women in the early Muslim period, and they continued in many, many places. Women were fighting wars in the days of Muhammad. Aisha, his wife, of course, interpreted the Quran, became a great authority on the text. So Islam never had an intention to push women aside. Never. And I, you know, any Muslim who tells you that doesn't really know his faith, absolutely. Yeah, this is my issue with Ayan Hirsi Ali and Irshad Manji. They exaggerate and generalize. Generalization is bad history. It really is wrong. How could you generalize all those cultures that adopted Islam, all this rich civilization with its highs and lows? How could you generalize about it and say, oh, they're all anti-Semitic, or they're all anti-women? Come on. You know, you've got to be very careful how you really phrase these issues. Yes?
I've got a question because, and it falls a bit on what you just said. Because, of course, some women like Ms. Aran and, I mean, I think there's a difference between her and Irshad, but, of course, also have this, you know, because they're women, they're Muslim women, they have, and you know, get kind of celebrated by the West, have a real authority, right? Because part of what feminism.
Because they're women, they have authority, you think?
No. What I'm trying to say is, you know, they are highly embraced and celebrated by the West because they confirm certain stereotypes. But of course, it becomes very difficult as a Western feminist for me to speak against them because they have the authority of being Muslims. For example, Hilsi is coming. She's invited to the Festival of Knowledge here at the University of Agrada, which I personally find very problematic because of this.
Who is this?
Hilsi Alan. What's her
name? Oh, Ayan Hirsi Ali?
Yes, coming.
Oh, she's coming.
She's a major speaker at the Festival of Knowledge.
Oh, I see.
And I find, you know, knowing the bit of the European context, you know, I'm really concerned about this, but to speak up against her publicly as a non-Muslim woman is very problematic, right? Because she has the authenticity factor that I as a, or that that Western women don't have. Right?
Well,
she gets to have the voice, to represent the voice of Islam. So I think there's a real problem for Western feminists who are critical of these women to actually speak up publicly.
That's very interesting. But you know, they've been critical of Iranian women under the Islamic Republic, so why aren't you critical of somebody who goes on the other deep end of liberalism and neoliberalism?
Oh, I'm very critical of them, but they have, you know, I think what they have is the so-called authenticity.
They're not authentic, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
They are a product of a confused period in Muslim-Western relations. They inhabit a spot in Muslim-Western relations which are really the abyss. Because this is worse than the Crusades. We don't even communicate with each other as Muslims and Westerners. You agree?
I do. I actually think it's very interesting. What they've done at this Festival of Ideas, it's called. It's a series, a number of days. They have a series of very distinguished visitors coming. Hirsi Ali is one of the speakers in a session with a woman who's written a narrative called Slave. And she's from, her name is Mende Nazar.
Mm-hmm.
She's from the Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
She was kidnapped by Arabs when she was 12 years old.
Okay.
So it's going to be a really extraordinary session where there's going to be no critique. This is going to be a total... And the other thing is, in this whole Festival of Ideas, which lasts for days, They are the only two women, other than a very distinguished Canadian woman writer, Myrna Kostash, who lives here, who's just given a national award for lifetime achievement. So she's a wonderful speaker. Those are the only women. There are no other women in this entire festival, 3 days. So I just think it's appalling.
But you know what's going on. I mean, it's very obvious. You're picking up critics of the Arab and Muslim world who are not necessarily legitimate critics. I mean, when you pick up a woman from the southern Sudan, the southern Sudanese are very anti-Arab, anti-Islamic, and there's a history why they rebel against the north. The British divided them from the northern part of the Sudan. There's a whole history to that. So people ignore all this and bring women just because they're women, which goes to show you, American feminists are not concerned with anything outside of the perspective of gender. That is wrong.
I don't think it's American feminists who put together this program.
But I'm saying Western feminists should look beyond the perspective of gender. That's the whole point.
Okay.
You know, you should go beyond that.
Personally, I actually think we should protest this. I think this is appalling.
Yeah.
This is absolutely illegitimate.
I wish I was here. Yeah.
Of festival ideas of international women's thinking. It's
yes.
not.
And last year was Salman Rushdie.
Excuse me?
And last year was Salman Rushdie.
Salman Rushdie? Well, I mean, how legitimate is Salman Rushdie in our eyes?
Right.
A man who sees nothing is wrong in blasting his own religion and his own faith. I mean, you know. He didn't have to write those books he wrote. You know that. He's a great writer. But he didn't have to hit you right between the eyes with those books. There's somebody there. Yes, please.
You know, I'm sort of in agreement with you that, you know, we need to have our own locations, particularly when you're talking about your own traditions. But then I was just wondering that because we are located in the Western academia, I mean, what are our locations vis-a-vis women like us who have their locations, let's say, in India or Iran or whatever. So I think that, you know, what Susan raised about, you know, authority, the question of legitimacy and authority, you spoke very forcefully about what colonialism did well, in India and elsewhere, where, you know, men took up this, you know, lead role, you know, sort of upliftment, the use of the word upliftment of women. I'm just wondering whether Gayatri Spivak or, you know, some of us are, you know, sort of similarly complicit with that, except that we are located over here. So critiquing tradition by being located in academia, we are complicit with, as opposed to critiquing tradition and being an integral, organic part of that tradition in locations where activism and academia go together. Right? So I just want your response on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have no answer to that. I think I agree with that. I agree with that. Yes.
Edward Said had a phrase describing Naipaul, and he said he's basically quite consciously chosen to be a witness for the prosecution. And what you are seeing with these two figures, Irshad Manji and Ayan Hirsi, they are this terrible commodity embraced by the neoconservative institutions. And actually, they are very celebrated. Last month, Ayan Hirsi Ali was on Ideas for a whole hour. She was presented as the authority on Islam.
Yeah, that's really true.
As a feminist authority on Islam. And Irshad Manji denied that was Obama became accepted the acceptance speech. She was the voice of Islam on CBC in Canada as an authority on Islam. So the thing is that the question from your perspective, do these figures who are embraced in the West, in the world of academia, do they have any grounding in the Arab and Islamic world? Do they know who Ayan Hirsi Ali is? Or
they don't know them. No, they're utterly unknown and unimportant in the Muslim and Arab world. We have a very vibrant feminist movement of various strands. No, these women don't make a difference. That's a problem. That's a big gulf between us back there and here. A big gulf between us. Yeah. I think you should tell them who Naipaul is, because, you know.
No, I think
they know who Naipaul is? Yeah. Edward Said really hated his guts.
Yeah.
Please.
Just a little comment, and please excuse me, I don't mean anything against anyone in the West in general. The West in general looks for anyone who hates Islam and adopt him or her, like Ma'arshad, and put her in a leading position to speak against Islam.
She's very convenient. Her ideology is conveniently placed to serve the ends of the neocons. Yeah. So, you know, and you're right. Women don't dare argue with her.
And the same with this guy and Dexter's, who never saw the Quran.
Oh, the minister. The minister.
I never read it, and he wanted to burn it.
Yeah, well, anybody who wants to burn a text is a shame.
That's for the FBI.
It's a shame. Please.
I'm a little concerned about your arguments, because I feel like you're...
Can you please speak higher?
I'm a little concerned about your arguments, because you're validating an academic voice, and you're not recognizing any legitimacy in the voice that comes from grassroots. Now, I'm not saying that there are serious problems with the Sharanji's arguments that she is reductionist and maybe doesn't understand the history adequately, but that she does represent a Muslim woman's experience.
You mean Irshad Manji? Irshad Manji?
Yes.
Yeah.
And she represents a Muslim Canadian woman's experience. And so I think it's dangerous to start saying, my voice is valid, hers is not. We need to find where there's dialogue between those voices if we intend to move forward. Because I really appreciated the meeting that you gave, where you said we have to live with both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I found your talk a bit important for Islam. And I do recognize that it is being vilified and we're celebrating people who speak against Islam. But by then turning to you and saying their voice is invalid, That's just not legitimate.
No, I'm not.
So it's to find the middle ground between those voices.
No, I'm not delegitimizing her voice because she's not academic. I don't think she's actually genuine grassroots. I think, to me, a grassroots voice would reflect the experience of the majority of Muslim women in North America. And that's not true. That's really her experience. What she does is that she sets up herself as an authority on Islam, which I find to be infantile. You see, when you take this position that I know about Islam, Muslims are anti-Semites, Muslims believe in female, genital female circumcision, and she's not an authority on that, you have to correct her. You have to say that is absolutely wrong. It doesn't have anything to do with my disdain for the grassroots. I don't think my voice is necessarily an academic voice as such, but I wouldn't put myself on the line about something that I don't know about. I wouldn't stand here before you, for instance, and argue about Western history that I don't know about. I will argue with you about the history that I know about. But she sets herself to be an expert on something that she really is not an expert about. And I think we have to say that, so that she will not be taken to be an authority, because she's not an authority. Yes? You were smiling at me all the time, so that's a good sign.
I have a question, about the other section here, Ishad Manji, neoliberal. But on the other hand, we have a group of leaders at the community level who are ultra-conservative and who are almost, are anti-Islamic feminists, who have their own agenda of Islam and who tend to put that agenda forward to the extent that any voice that is, the Islamic feminist voice is the one that is curbed. And this is what we see at the community level, which doesn't necessarily come at the level that we are talking about. It's not the academia level, but at the same time, that voice of a Muslim woman is also the one that slows the progress that, you were talking about, the authority and the progress. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that other side?
I shouldn't answer that. I think some of the men in the room should. Is there really such a conservative male leadership around here that inhibits female voices?
We had a conference about this 3 days ago, last Monday, as a matter of fact, and both David and I talked about this. Especially in relation to the Muslim community in the city, that's a big issue. But I don't think that this is only anti-women. It's also anti-men who want to be democratic.
It may be, anti the whole democratic trend.
That's a big issue here with the Muslim community.
The problem comes when you import the clergy as they are, with their mindset, and place them in a society like this to teach what they come from without trying to understand what's going on here. And we have a lot of these here. And not just within Islam, with all religions. You import these clergy and you don't take the time, or they don't take the time to
understand, but they just blurt out what they are coming with. You have a major problem in this way.
But it creates a culture of fear.
Not just fear. It creates a culture of split right down the middle.
It intimidates, there's no question. It's extremely intimidating, yeah. Yeah. Okay, guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.